Nemoto presents American presidents. President Bill Clinton. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 27 minutes. On a humid August night in 1963, a teenage boy from Hope, Arkansas, stood in the East Room of the White House and shook hands with the President of the United States. John F. Kennedy looked thinner and more fragile than he did on television. But to the 17-year-old Bill Clinton, he seemed like the living embodiment of possibility, youth, ambition, public service bound together in a single image. The moment lasted only a few seconds. A photograph captured the handshake. History later attached great significance to it. For Clinton himself, it lodged in his mind as a kind of private vow. Somehow, someday he too would stand at the center of American politics. Bill Clinton's road from that handshake to the presidency is one of the most improbable and intensely American stories of the late 20th century. It is a story of talent and discipline, but also of appetite and risk, of dazzling political skill and self-inflicted wounds, of economic expansion and social reform shadowed by scandal and impeachment. As the 42nd President of the United States, Clinton presided over the end of the Cold War era, the rise of the internet economy, the signing of major trade and welfare laws, and intervention in conflicts abroad. He also left office with a complicated legacy, his achievements locked in permanent argument with his failures. To understand Clinton, one has to begin not in Washington, but in a small southern town marked by poverty, alcohol, and resilience. William Jefferson Blythe III was born on August 19, 1946, in Hope, Arkansas, 3 months after his father died in a car accident. His mother, Virginia, was left a young widow, working as a nurse anesthetist and leaving Bill for periods with his grandparents while she went off for training. The boy's early life toggled between warmth and instability, doting relatives but also the sense that the adults around him were stretched and struggling, doing what they could in a harsh world. Virginia eventually remarried to a car salesman named Roger Clinton. The marriage brought a new last name and a new set of problems. Roger was charming when sober and frightening when drunk. Clinton would later speak about the chaos of alcoholism in the household, shouting, broken promises, fear. As a teenager, he sometimes stood between his stepfather and his mother to protect her. The experience etched into him both a fierce determination to control his own destiny and a lifelong empathy for children in troubled homes. Years later, as president, he would talk about children of circumstance with a depth that came from experience. At school, Bill Clinton discovered two things that would shape his future: a facility with words and a love of public life. He played the saxophone, joined student government, threw himself into debate. Teachers noticed that he could absorb complex material quickly and communicate it in plain language. He learned how to charm adults, how to remember names, how to make people feel seen. In the small world of Arkansas high school politics, he was already practicing the skills that would one day carry him to the White House. College opened that world further. Clinton attended Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., majoring in international affairs at the School of Foreign Service. The late 1960s were years of turbulence: the Vietnam War, civil rights protests, assassinations. Clinton interned for Senator J. William Fulbright, a prominent critic of the war, and absorbed both the idealism and disillusionment of his generation. He watched Washington up close. The marble buildings, the committee hearings, the demonstrations outside. He was like a sponge, soaking up the rhythms of national power. He won a Rhodes Scholarship to study at Oxford, a rare honor for a boy from Arkansas. In England, he encountered a wider world of students, ideas, and anti-war activism. He wrestled with the question of military service as the Vietnam draft loomed over his age cohort. His attempts to navigate the system, seeking deferments, contemplating service, then ultimately avoiding combat, would later return to haunt him in the political arena, where opponents painted him as a draft dodger. But in those years, he was one of millions of young Americans trying to reconcile patriotism, conscience, and fear. Returning to the United States, he attended Yale Law School. There, in the law library and seminar rooms, he met Hillary Rodham, a tough, brilliant student from Illinois who shared his intellectual interests and belief in public engagement. She was serious where he was gregarious, sharper-edged where he was smooth, but they recognized in each other a fierce drive and a willingness to work hard. Their partnership, romantic and political, would become one of the most consequential and scrutinized in modern American history. After Yale, the couple moved to Arkansas. Clinton taught law at the University of Arkansas and almost immediately jumped into politics, running for Congress in 1974. He lost, but only narrowly, in a conservative district during the aftermath of Watergate. The campaign, though unsuccessful, confirmed what many already suspected. He was a formidable political talent. He could walk into a room of strangers and, within an hour, know their names, their concerns, their family situations. He listened more than he talked, but when he talked, he could connect policy to people's lives in a way that felt concrete. In 1976, he ran for and won the office of Arkansas Attorney General. 2 years later, at just 32, he was elected governor. Clinton's first term as governor was rocky. He pushed for reforms and investments that many Arkansas voters saw as too fast, too expensive, or out of touch with local realities. A controversial increase in vehicle registration fees, education proposals that felt imposed rather than discussed, and a perception that he was more interested in national attention than local patients gave his opponents ammunition. In 1980, he lost his re-election bid. It was a humiliating setback, the boy wonder from hope, tossed out by his own state. Clinton later referred to himself as the youngest ex-governor in the history of the country. But he was not finished. In the 2 years that followed, he listened. He traveled the state, talked to voters in cafes and living rooms, recalibrated his style. He learned to slow down, to explain more, to show that he understood the day-to-day frustrations of people in small towns and rural communities. When he ran again in 1982, he did so with a humbler tone and a sharpened message focused on practical improvements: schools, roads, jobs. He won, and this time he held on, serving multiple terms. As governor, he became known for his emphasis on education reform, including raising teacher standards and pay, lengthening the school year, and introducing testing. He pushed for investments in infrastructure to attract new businesses to Arkansas. He negotiated with corporate leaders and teachers' unions, trying to position his poor rural state as a place where companies could invest and families could believe the future for their children might be better than the present. National Democrats began to see him as part of a new generation: Southern, moderate, pro-business but still attentive to social issues, a bridge between old New Deal liberalism and a more centrist politics. By the late 1980s, the Democratic Party was in trouble at the presidential level. It had lost three consecutive elections, two of them to Ronald Reagan and one to Reagan's vice president, George H.W. Bush. Many voters associated Democrats with high taxes, crime, and perceived weakness abroad. Clinton and a group known as the New Democrats argued that the party needed to embrace a different message: tough on crime, fiscally responsible, supportive of markets but committed to opportunity and fairness. It was a posture aimed at middle-class and suburban voters who had drifted toward the Republicans, people who liked civil rights and public schools but also wanted safe neighborhoods and balanced budgets. Clinton's national debut came in 1988, when he delivered a long, meandering nominating speech for Michael Dukakis at the Democratic National Convention. The speech was widely panned for its length. Late-night comedian Johnny Carson joked that it felt endless. But Clinton went on Carson's show, made fun of himself, and charmed the audience. The episode showed both his capacity for misjudgment and his ability to recover with disarming candor. In 1992, Clinton ran for president. The incumbent, George H.W. Bush, was a decorated war hero who had recently led a successful coalition in the Gulf War, but the U.S. economy had slipped into recession. Factories closed, middle-class families felt squeezed, wages stagnated. Clinton's campaign slogan captured the central reality of the race: it's the economy, stupid. He talked about jobs, healthcare, education, and the anxieties of ordinary Americans watching a global economy they didn't feel they controlled. He also pitched himself as a man from a place called Hope, someone who understood hardship. He played his saxophone on late-night television, signaling generational change. Where Bush appeared patrician and somewhat removed, Clinton came across as intense, accessible, relentlessly engaged, a policy wonk and a retail politician in one. The campaign was bruising. Clinton faced accusations about his personal life, his draft record, and his character. Allegations of infidelity surfaced. Questions about whether he had dodged the Vietnam draft dogged him. Clinton responded with a mixture of denial, explanation, and a plea for voters to focus on the issues. He appeared on 60 Minutes with Hillary to address rumors about their marriage, presenting themselves as a couple that had worked through difficulties and chosen to stay together. For many, it was an uncomfortable spectacle. For others, it was evidence of resilience and honesty, or at least a willingness to confront private matters in public. In November 1992, Clinton won, becoming at 46 one of the youngest presidents in modern history. He took office in January 1993 with a Democratic Congress and a sense that the country was ready for generational change. The Cold War was over. The Soviet Union had dissolved. The U.S. stood as the sole superpower. At home, however, anxiety simmered about wages, healthcare costs, crime, and cultural change. Clinton's early presidency mixed ambition with miscalculation. He moved quickly on several fronts, proposing a major economic stimulus, lifting the ban on gays in the military, and tasking Hillary with leading a sweeping healthcare reform effort. The attempt to allow gay Americans to serve openly in the military ran into fierce resistance from the Pentagon and Congress, resulting in the compromise policy known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The policy allowed gay service members to serve as long as they kept their orientation private. It was praised by some as better than outright exclusion and condemned by others as institutionalized hypocrisy and discrimination. The health care plan was even more ambitious. Hillary Clinton chaired a task force that worked largely behind closed doors, producing a dense, complex proposal designed to expand coverage and control costs. The White House rolled it out as a detailed package ready for Congress to pass. Instead, it met a wall of opposition. Insurers, small businesses, Republicans, and many moderate Democrats balked. Television ads warned of government interference in doctor-patient relationships. The proposal never even came to a vote. It became a symbol of technocratic overreach and political misreading, and it badly damaged the administration's political capital. Yet on the economy, Clinton scored significant early successes. In 1993, he pushed through a budget that raised taxes on higher-income Americans and trimmed spending, aiming to bring down the federal deficit. Republicans warned it would hurt growth. Not a single Republican in either chamber voted for it. Over time, however, that budget coincided with a long period of expansion, falling unemployment, and eventually budget surpluses. Clinton also signed the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which created a trade bloc between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA was supported by many business leaders and economists who believed it would make North America more competitive globally, but criticized by labor unions and some progressives who feared job losses and downward pressure on wages. The debate around that agreement foreshadowed the trade battles that would define politics decades later. In 1994, Clinton signed a major crime bill that funded more police officers, created new prisons, and expanded the list of crimes eligible for the death penalty. The bill also included provisions for community policing and a ban on certain assault weapons. At the time, many urban leaders and groups supported the bill, seeing it as a response to high crime rates that had made neighborhoods feel like war zones. Later, critics argued that it contributed to mass incarceration, particularly of Black and Latino men, and fed a carceral system that punished poverty and addiction rather than addressing their roots. Clinton himself would eventually express regret about some of its consequences. He also signed the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, in 1996, defining marriage for federal purposes as between one man and one woman and allowing states to refuse recognition of same-sex marriages performed elsewhere. At the time, public opinion overwhelmingly opposed gay marriage, and the law was seen by many politicians as a defensive move to head off a push for a constitutional amendment. Years later, as the country's views changed and DOMA was struck down by the courts, the law became another mark against Clinton among many LGBTQ+ advocates and their allies. The midterm elections of 1994 were a political earthquake. Republicans, led by Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America, won control of both the House and Senate for the first time in 40 years. Clinton was suddenly a Democratic president facing a hostile Republican Congress. Many expected him to be a one-term president. Instead, Clinton adapted. He repositioned himself as a centrist willing to work with Republicans on certain issues while fighting them on others, a strategy that came to be known as triangulation. After a government shutdown showdown in 1995-96, in which GOP leaders overreached in trying to force spending cuts and the closure of federal services, Clinton presented himself as the defender of ordinary citizens against ideological extremism. Televised images of closed national parks and furloughed workers hurt the Republicans more than the White House. Clinton's famous declaration that the era of big government is over captured his approach. Not anti-government, but willing to reshape it to be leaner, more targeted, more in tune with voters' skepticism. In his second term, Clinton signed welfare reform legislation that fundamentally changed the American social safety net. The bill ended the federal guarantee of cash assistance to poor families and replaced it with block grants to states and time-limited benefits tied to work requirements. Supporters argued it encouraged employment, reduced dependency, and responded to public frustration with a welfare system many saw as broken. Critics charged that it left many vulnerable families with inadequate support, pushed people into low-wage jobs without security, and made the safety net contingent on economic conditions beyond their control. The law remains one of the most controversial pieces of social policy of the 1990s. Clinton also presided over a technological and economic transformation. The 1990s saw the rise of the internet, personal computers, and a stock market boom driven by technology companies. Businesses reorganized around just-in-time production and global supply chains. Productivity increased, unemployment fell, inflation stayed low. By the late 1990s, the U.S. government was running budget surpluses for the first time in decades. Clinton took credit for this performance, pointing to his deficit reduction policies and partnership with a Republican Congress on some fiscal issues. His critics argued that he benefited from larger structural trends, the afterglow of the Cold War peace dividend, and the luck of a technology bubble that would eventually burst. Financial deregulation was another hallmark of the era. Clinton signed legislation that repealed parts of the Glass-Steagall Act, the New Deal-era law that had separated commercial and investment banking. He also backed measures that limited regulation of certain financial derivatives. At the time, these moves were widely supported by both parties and framed as modernizing outdated rules. After the 2008 financial crisis, many would look back at them as part of the story of how Wall Street grew so complex and risky. Clinton later defended some of the choices while acknowledging that the regulatory system had not kept pace with innovation. On the world stage, Clinton's record was mixed but consequential. He sought to use American power to support democracy and stop mass atrocities, but often hesitated or intervened late. In the Balkans, as Yugoslavia fractured and ethnic violence tore apart Bosnia and later Kosovo, the administration initially stumbled. The horror of the Srebrenica massacre and images of civilians under siege eventually pushed the US and NATO to use force. Air campaigns and diplomacy helped bring about the Dayton Accords in Bosnia, which ended the war there, and later helped end Serbian repression in Kosovo. Many saw these interventions as examples of a new kind of humanitarian use of American power, imperfect but better than indifference. In Rwanda, by contrast, the U.S. and other Western powers failed to act. In 1994, as Hutu extremists carried out genocide against Tutsis and moderate Hutus, the Clinton administration avoided the word genocide and resisted calls for robust intervention. The United Nations presence was scaled back rather than reinforced. Later, Clinton would say that his inaction on Rwanda was one of his deepest regrets, a failure of moral and political imagination. The Middle East was another area of intense focus. Clinton invested significant time and political capital in trying to advance peace between Israelis and Palestinians. The Oslo Accords of the early 1990s raised hopes of a two-state solution. Clinton hosted historic handshakes between Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn, images that appeared to signal a new beginning. Yet the process ultimately faltered amid mutual mistrust, violence, assassinations, and political shifts on both sides. The failure to secure a final peace settlement left a lasting sense of unfinished work and deepened cynicism in the region. In Northern Ireland, however, Clinton's involvement helped support a peace process that eventually produced the Good Friday Agreement. By granting visas, appointing envoys, and using the symbolic power of the American presidency, he provided encouragement and pressure at key moments for the warring parties to reach compromise. It was one of the bright spots in an otherwise uneven record of conflict resolution. Even as Clinton's administration dealt with complex policy issues, his personal life and past actions never fully disappeared from the political stage. In 1994, Paula Jones, a former Arkansas State employee, filed a lawsuit accusing him of sexual harassment during his time as governor. Clinton denied the allegations and fought the case in court. The lawsuit would eventually intersect with another scandal that nearly consumed his presidency. In 1998, news broke that Clinton had had a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky, a young White House intern, and that he had denied the affair under oath during a deposition in the Paula Jones case. The revelation rocked Washington. Clinton's initial public statement, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky," would become infamous. Over time, evidence mounted that he had been misleading at best, lying at worst. Under enormous pressure, he eventually acknowledged an inappropriate relationship. The affair and cover-up led to impeachment proceedings in the House of Representatives. The charges centered on perjury and obstruction of justice, not the affair itself, but Clinton's efforts to conceal it and mislead investigators. The country was bitterly divided. Many Americans disapproved of Clinton's behavior and lies, but also saw the pursuit of impeachment as partisan overreach by Republicans who had long disliked him. Clinton's job approval ratings remained relatively high, especially as the economy remained strong. In December 1998, the House voted to impeach Clinton on two articles. In early 1999, the Senate held a trial presided over by Chief Justice William Rehnquist. The outcome was never seriously in doubt. The Senate fell far short of the two-thirds majority needed to remove him from office. Clinton was acquitted and finished his term weakened but still in command of the presidency. The scandal left deep marks on Clinton's reputation, on Hillary's public image, on the way many Americans viewed politics, sex, and power. For some, Clinton's survival in office despite his personal misconduct and dishonesty symbolized a decline in moral standards, proof that character no longer mattered. For others, the episode showed the dangers of weaponizing private failings for partisan ends and the capacity of politicians to survive media storms if the public feels the stakes are overblown. Either way, it shaped the political climate that his successors would inherit, contributing to a cynicism that made later scandals and accusations feel like part of an endless, numbing cycle. In January 2001, Clinton left office with high approval ratings despite the shadow of impeachment. The economy was still largely strong, though signs of the dot-com bubble collapse were emerging. The U.S. was at peace, outwardly confident, seemingly secure. Within months, the attacks of September 11, 2001, would shatter that sense of security and shift the country into a new era, casting Clinton's presidency as a kind of hinge between the post-Cold War moment and the age of terrorism. In the years after his presidency, Clinton reinvented himself as a global philanthropist and elder statesman. He founded the Clinton Foundation, focusing on global health, economic development, and climate issues, partnering with governments and private donors to fund HIV/AIDS treatment, vaccine programs, and development projects. He worked with former rival George H.W. Bush on disaster relief efforts after the Asian tsunami and Hurricane Katrina, demonstrating a capacity for bipartisan cooperation that contrasted sharply with the partisan warfare of his impeachment years. His ability to connect with ordinary people remained intact. His speeches continued to draw crowds. He became a regular presence at Democratic conventions, often delivering the most anticipated and praised address. At the same time, debates about his legacy only grew more complex, especially as new conversations about gender, power and harassment reframed public views of his past behavior. For younger generations, the Lewinsky affair and the power imbalance it revealed looked different in the light of the hashtag MeToo era than it had in the 1990s. So how should we judge Bill Clinton looking back? His supporters point to a record of economic growth, deficit reduction, welfare changes that they say promoted work, crime policies that coincided with lower crime rates, and efforts to use American influence for peace and human rights abroad. They see him as a pragmatic centrist who modernized the Democratic Party, helped bring it back from the electoral wilderness, and navigated a period of rapid technological and global change with agility. His critics highlight the downsides of those same policies: trade deals that accelerated deindustrialization in some regions, crime and welfare laws that deepened inequality and hardship for the poorest, financial deregulation that, they argue, helped set the stage for the 2008 financial crisis. They focused, too, on his personal conduct. The dishonesty, the misuse of power in relationships with subordinates, the national trauma of impeachment precipitated by his own choices. For them, Clinton represents a politics that too often compromised principles for poll-tested positioning and treated serious moral issues as problems to be managed rather than confronted. Both views contain elements of truth. Bill Clinton's presidency is perhaps best understood as a mirror of the 1990s. Dynamic, optimistic, and full of confidence in globalization and technology, yet also marked by denial, excess, and a reluctance to confront the deeper fractures in American life. He governed with remarkable intelligence and adaptability, but also with a willingness to blur lines and take risks that would eventually catch up with him. For a listener following the long parade of American presidents, Clinton marks the end of one story and the uneasy beginning of another. He was the last president to serve entirely before September 11th, the last to preside over a world where the United States felt almost unchallenged, the last to ride a wave of unalloyed faith in markets and global integration before the backlashes began. The fights over trade, immigration, crime, and the role of government that he tried to triangulate his way through would explode in more polarized form in the decades after he left office. He came from a place called hope. He spoke fluently to the aspirations of a diverse, restless country. He left behind a complicated inheritance, prosperity and policy innovations on one side, unresolved inequalities and moral controversies on the other. To study Bill Clinton is to study the contradictions of modern America itself, its generosity and its selfishness, its drive and its blind spots, its hunger for leadership and its suspicion of those who seek it.